led us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn again to Chile, which on Monday marked the 50th anniversary of the U.S.-backed military coup that overthrew the democratically elected socialist president Salvador Allende and ushered in a 17-year dictatorship under the rule of General Augusto Pinochet, and during which some 40,000 people were politically executed, disappeared, imprisoned, or tortured. Allende's daughter, the socialist senator Isabel Allende, spoke at Monday's commemoration ceremony in Santiago, not to be confused with the author.
I was the last person from my father's entourage to enter the palace along with other people on that day. We had a mandate to tell what happened then, what Unidad Popular stood for, and the barbarity that had started to rise. Memory is the first step to reach the truth, but we need more to reach justice, reparations, and to ensure that the acts committed on that day are not repeated.
In the days after the U.S.-backed military coup in Chile, September 11, 1973, that other September 11th, then U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger told President Richard Nixon, quote, in the Eisenhower period, we would be heroes and lamented that the media would not fully report on the U.S. role. That is changing now. Last week, a Chilean television channel broadcast a new documentary titled Operation Chile, Top Secret, that was based in part on declassified records about the coup that were obtained by the National Security Archives Chile Documentation Project. For more, we go to Santiago. We're joined by Peter Kornbluh, the director of the National Security Archives Chile Documentation Project. On the 30th anniversary of the coup in September 2003, he published the Pinochet file, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. On this, the 50th anniversary, 20 years later, the book has been revised and published in Chile for the first time. His latest piece for The Nation, Chile, the secrets the U.S. government continues to hide. Peter Kornbluh, welcome back to Democracy Now!, today from Chile. Can you talk about what is now known and what is not known about the U.S. role, especially as this has been the year that people have feted Henry Kissinger on his 100th birthday?
Well, Amy, I'm delighted to be with you and your audience on this poignant, powerful, dramatic, dynamic, and admittedly divisive 50th anniversary here in Chile. I was actually at the event yesterday where Senator Isabel Allende spoke. She was incredibly moving, particularly standing in front of the very building in which she last saw her father alive 50 years ago. And I do want to say to your audience that Nation magazine has published an excerpt of her memoir just yesterday, where in English, where she recounts that very day 50 years ago in dramatic and very, very heartbreaking detail. You know, there's a lot known about the U.S. role in Chile, but there's a lot to be reminded of as well. And then there are the secrets that remain. And just to give your audience a sense of what we know, 50 years ago today, on the 12th of September, 1973, Henry Kissinger called together a special interagency committee known as the WASAG, the Washington Special Action Group. And literally within 24 hours of the coup, he was in discussion with these interagency representatives on how to help the Pinochet regime consolidate. Even as people were being killed and their bodies dumped in the street and rounded up and put into a concentration camp at the stadium and bodies floating in the Mapocho River here in Santiago, Kissinger convened this committee, and we have the declassified memorandum of conversation. And, you know, actually the officials there just started joking about the coup. Kissinger told everybody President Nixon is concerned that we might want to send somebody to Salvador Allende's funeral. I told him that we weren't going to do that. And then somebody pipes up and says, well, Mr. Secretary, you could go. And then another official says, our policy on Allende worked pretty well. And this gives you a sense of the attitude of the U.S. officials and the efforts made literally in the first minutes to help the military regime consolidate. After 3 years of an effort to destabilize the constitutional government of Chile, the immediate effort to help the unconstitutional dictatorial military regime consolidate its power for the next 17 years. There are other secrets that we want to get out. The Chilean government has asked the Biden administration for a special declassification diplomacy gesture for this 50th anniversary. So far, only two documents have been declassified. There are many more that have been asked for that hopefully, you know, at some point will come out. It's just been announced that President Boric will come to Washington for the anniversary of the Letelier Moffat assassination, and that would be a good time for the Biden administration to release some more documents as a gesture to Chile.
And explain who Orlando Letelier was and Ronnie Moffat and their assassination on Embassy Row in Washington, D.C.
I mean, you know, the horror of U.S. policy and its support for the Pinochet coup and the Pinochet regime is that that regime turned out to be a regime of state-sponsored international terrorism. That terrorism came to the streets of our nation's capital on September 21st, 1976, 3 years after the coup. Pinochet personally ordered his secret police to send a death squad, basically, to Washington. Agents of the intelligence service here in Santiago, known as DINA, put a car bomb under the front side of the automobile of the leading opponent of the Pinochet regime, former Chilean ambassador Washington, Orlando Letelier, and he and his 25-year-old colleague Ronnie Carpenter Moffat were killed in this act of terrorism when the bomb exploded. So every year there is a ceremony at Sheridan Circle, and this year, because of this kind of special anniversary, President Boric, it has just been announced just minutes ago, will be at Sheridan Circle. He gave a rousing speech yesterday, basically saying there's always an alternative to political violence, and it's time for the world, which is in a deep struggle between democracy and the forces of authoritarianism, to come to an agreement. The civil discord, even if people disagree, even if parties disagree, is far preferable to the Pinochets of the world.
You know, I was just listening to a speech you gave, Peter Kornbluh, where you contrasted what Henry Kissinger wrote in his series of memoirs about the U.S. role in Chile and what you actually have documentation of, because like President Nixon, Henry Kissinger recorded his conversations, his phone conversation. What were they called? Telcoms, telephone conversations, telephone memos.
Telcoms.
Can you explain what it was he said, and specifically about the meeting he had with Pinochet, what he said he talked about, what he actually talked about with the contemporaneous information coming out?
Well, we have Kissinger's telcons of his conversations with Richard Nixon, which is kind of ironic because Nixon secretly taped his phone conversations, and he didn't know that Kissinger secretly taped his phone conversations. And when they talked to each other, they were both secretly taping their conversations. In the case that you're mentioning, Henry Kissinger came to Santiago, Chile, where I am right now, in June of 1976. And he met with Augusto Pinochet. And his aides all told him, you have to be absolutely clear with Pinochet that he has to return to civilian rule and that he has to stop, you know, crimes against humanity, stop violating human rights. Because Chile has become a cause célèbre. This is literally the memorandums that are going to Kissinger's, his briefing papers for this meeting. Chile has become a cause célèbre, much like Franco's Spain. And the whole world is watching. And all that Pinochet is going to understand from you is, you know, a direct kind of reproach for his conduct. And instead, Kissinger goes into the meeting and he tells Pinochet Kissinger's opinion, Pinochet is a victim of leftist propaganda around the world, and that the only crime he's committed is overthrowing a government that was going communist. And Kissinger basically says to him, we want to help you, not hurt you. You did a great service to the West. I'm here. I have to give a speech on human rights, but the speech is not directed at you. But, you know, it would help if you could clarify your position on human rights a little bit, because the U.S. Congress is breathing down my neck, and I'm not going to be able to give you aid because Congress is going to cut off that aid unless something changes here. But, you know, these platitudes to Pinochet are not mentioned in Kissinger's memoirs. Instead, in his memoirs, he goes in and says, oh, I talked to Pinochet about human rights. I talked to Pinochet about democracy. But we have the actual memorandum of conversation, not a telecon, but the memorandum of conversation that was taken from notes of Kissinger's own deputy at that meeting. And he doesn't mention democracy, really, ever. And his human rights issue is only kind of peripherally tied in to all these compliments that he gives to Pinochet. So, you know, the truth is in the declassified documents, not in the memoirs. Kissinger's memoirs are filled with self-serving spins on his role in history. And his role in history is recorded in great detail on Chile. He was the leading architect of the policies and strategies to overthrow Allende, and he was the leading enabler in the United States of government of a push to consolidate, help Pinochet consolidate his bloody regime.
I wanted to go back to 2016 to testimonies of survivors of torture under the Pinochet dictatorship. Revealed in an art exhibit, the government had sought to keep the testimony secret for decades. The stories were collected as part of a commission launched in 2003 to document torture under the dictatorship of U.S.-backed General Augusto Pinochet. In 2004, the Chilean government passed a law ordering the testimonies remain secret for 50 years until 2054. But in 2016, this project launched by the Chilean artist Francisco Papas Fritas and torture survivors succeeded in declassifying these testimonies. This is one of the torture survivors.
On London Street, I was held approximately 10 days. While I was there, I suffered all kinds of tortures, specifically sexual, political violence, psychologically torture threatening me with the detention of my children, and psychological torture forcing me to listen to how they tortured other people, which is something very difficult to endure. Psychologically, you're left traumatized, because when they torture you, in some way, you are all the time resisting. But when you listen to how they torture other people, and I have talked about this with several people, it is one of the most difficult things to endure.
That's Scarlett Mathieu Iguerico. Peter Kornbluh, as we wrap up, the importance of hearing these voices from 50 years ago and what they teach us about today. In the world, the power of the survivors and their testimony, and particularly with the United States, its role in the world.
Well, those testimonies, which, you know, are circulating here in Chile when victims are able to speak out, and some of them can and some of them can't because of the horrors they suffer. Those testimonies are so important. They're human reminders of the horrors, the nightmares of the Pinochet dictatorship. And Chile does not want to go down that route again, even though there are, you know, a significant amount of Pinochetistas here, a rising amount, who claim that Pinochet did nothing wrong, that the coup was inevitable, that the coup was Allende's fault, that the United States had no role, that Pinochet was a statesman. All those issues are under fierce discussion here as disinformation flows into Chile. And the declassified documents that the United States has lend tremendous evidence to the truth about what happened. And that truth we have to remember, not only for Chileans not to repeat the past, but for other countries in the world, including our own, where the forces of the right, very authoritarian voices, are rising into dangerous levels that actually threaten our democracy and others.
Well, I want to thank you, Peter Kornbluh, for joining us. Director of the National Security Archives Chile Documentation Project has just published a revised edition of the Pinochet file, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability. And it also has been published in Chile for the first time. We're also going to link to our conversation with Ariel Dorfman yesterday, one of the last people to see Salvador Allende alive in the Moneda, the Chilean palace in Santiago, on September 11th. Also, he spoke about his new book, The Suicide Museum. And we're also posting at democracynow.org our interviews with Isabel Allende, the other Isabel. The Isabel we just heard is the Chilean state senator who spoke so movingly about what happened 50 years ago. Isabel Allende, the Chilean-American author, also talks about that day, September 11th. 1973, the other September 11th, 50 years ago this week. Next up, as interest begins accruing again on federal student loans, we'll speak to Astrid Taylor, author of the new book, The Age of Insecurity, Coming Together as Things Fall Apart. Back in 30 seconds. The Child, performed by Sonny Rollins. The jazz great turned 93 this week. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. The COVID-19 student loan forbearance ended this month, and some 40 million Americans once saw interest begin to accrue again on their federal student loans on September 1st. Next month, repayments on the loans themselves will resume. As people struggle to make their first payments in more than 3 years, many are being targeted by robocalls that promote scams which offer help that is not real. Student loan borrowers in Minnesota who paid one of the 52 companies suspected of falsely promising them loan forgiveness could get help after the state launched an investigation. This is Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison.
We at the Minnesota Attorney General's office opened up an investigation into some companies that are purporting to help students do debt relief. But if they tell you that they can forgive your loan or cancel your loan, you know, they probably cannot. Really, only that's something the federal government can do. Know that if it's too good to be true, it probably is.
Last week, the Biden administration announced 4 million student loan borrowers are now enrolled in a new so-called income-driven repayment plan called Saving on a Valuable Education, or SAVE, that it launched after the Supreme Court ruled against Biden's plan to forgive up to $20,000 in federal student loans per person in June. Meanwhile, another tool launched by the Debt Collective helps people apply to the Department of Education and ask them to cancel the borrower's debt. As the website notes, quote, filling out this form creates an individual demand letter tailored to your own student debt story, calling on the Department of Education to use its powers to cancel not just your debt, but everyone's. For more on all of this, we're joined by Astrid Taylor, organizer with the Debt Collective. She has also just published her new book titled The Age of Insecurity, Coming Together as Things Fall Apart. Thanks for being with us, Astra, as you go on your book tour for The Age of Insecurity. Let's start off by talking about this month, what's just happened September 1st and then October 1st, and what you're suggesting happens.
Yes. In terms of student debt payments, the COVID pause, as you mentioned, has ended. And interest has begun to accrue, and people are going to be expected to make payments October 1st. This is entirely unnecessary. The sky hasn't fallen over the last few years with student loan payments paused. It's proof that the government doesn't actually need the payments of student debtors to function, which should make us ask why these payments are being turned on at all. And the Debt Collective's position has always been that the President of the United States has the authority through the Higher Education Act of 1965 to cancel all student debt. This is the legal authority that President Biden has said he will now try to use in the wake of the Supreme Court decision that shot down his initial debt relief plan. We're trying to push him to actually do that and use his full powers because none of this is necessary. This debt can be erased. Again, the government doesn't need student debtors to pay their bills to keep operating. And, you know, an incredible amount of suffering is about to commence. I mean, one thing we're hearing from people who are filling out our new student debt release tool is that they're going to have to make impossible decisions between paying their student loans and paying their rent, or paying their medical or dental bills. We are hearing from people who are considering suicide. And so it's absolutely urgent that the president fulfill his promise and address this crisis and cancel student debt. And I encourage everyone who's listening, who has federal student loans, to take 10 or 20 minutes and use our student debt release tool and become part of this movement to push for debt abolition.
And again, explain why you don't use the term debt forgiveness, but debt cancellation or relief.
Debtors have done nothing wrong. You know, we believe that education is a right. People go to college because they're curious, because they want to have a career that requires certain professional training. This isn't a crime. This isn't something that you should need forgiveness for if you can't pay your student loans. You know, it's absolutely ridiculous that a four-year college experience can cost, you know, upwards of $200,000 in this country. So our position is that debtors shouldn't be blamed, therefore they shouldn't ask for forgiveness. And instead, the Debt Collective uses the language of debt cancellation, debt relief, and debt abolition, because we think that the people who actually are morally culpable are the folks who built this outrageous debt for education system that weighs heaviest on the people who have the least.
Explain what SAVE is, Astra.
SAVE is a new name for another iteration of an income-driven repayment plan. You know, people who have had student loans for a while will be familiar. There was IDR programs in various forms, and it's just yet another tweak from the Department of Education where they're attempting to fix a broken system without really fixing it. And the fix is obvious. We need robust public investment in education to make education a democratic right. This isn't a fanciful idea. You know, a few generations ago, public university was free or close to it for people who attended. And so the SAVE program, you know, might work. It might be a beneficial program for some people to enroll in. It is increasing monthly payments for other people, but that's beside the point. The point is we've seen these fixes before, and they're not real fixes. they're just Band-Aids on a system that needs to be completely overhauled. You know, so the Debt Collective is critical of this program. It certainly is no substitute for debt cancellation. And it, again, is no fix. What we need is public investment so that people can afford to actually learn, and so that we can have an educated citizenry without demanding that not just young people, but all people who have to go back to school mortgage their futures. It's, you know, the real fix is obvious, and actually the Debt Collective is committed for fighting for that.
And your thoughts on Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison going after 52 companies suspected of falsely promising them loan forgiveness could get help?
Well, this is a problem. You know, these scammers wouldn't be able to scam people if the system wasn't so confusing. I mean, the SAVE program is a great example of that. The student lending system is incredibly Byzantine. It's overwhelming. I mean, I know people who are student loan experts, who are student loan lawyers, and have still had problems as they've enrolled in these various programs trying to get public service loan forgiveness or enroll in versions of income-driven repayment. So, you know, this is the broken system is what's creating opportunities for these scam artists. So here, you know, if you want to get rid of the scammers, cancel student loans and do it automatically and immediately without demanding onerous paperwork. You know, the Department of Education can cancel student loans overnight without making people apply. And so it is these confusing processes that is creating opportunities for scammers to take advantage of people who are financially struggling.
Astra, let's talk about your new book, The Age of Insecurity, Coming Together as Things Fall Apart. You write about student debt, the climate crisis, even 9/11, the anniversary this week. You write, how we understand and respond to insecurity is one of the most urgent questions of our moment, for nothing less than the future security of our species hangs in the balance. Talk about how you put this all together and people's feelings of insecurity, even as the Biden administration touts a strong economy, and what you think needs to happen, what the Debt Collective is recommending.
Yeah, this is kind of a kaleidoscopic book that mixes politics and economics and history and a bit of memoir that's hopefully kind of humorous to look at the way insecurity is really essential to our economy. When we were your previous guest, Jyoti Ghosh, who's brilliant, you did a great job of laying out the way inequality is spiraling today. And a lot of my work has focused on the problem of inequality and the obscene concentration of wealth and poverty. But insecurity is how living in a radically unequal world is actually felt day after day. And, you know, if organizing with the debt collective has taught me anything, it's that economic issues are always also emotional ones. You know, the spike of shame when the bill collector calls or are foreboding about saving for retirement, you know, and of course also our anxieties about our collapsing planet and climate change. So I think insecurity is pervasive, but what I'm trying to show in the book is it's actually built into our economy. It's not just something that we feel spontaneously. We're all insecure by design, or something I call manufactured insecurity. We see this with advertising. You know, no advertisement will ever tell you that you're great and the world needs changing. And we see this in, official monetary policy that tries to ramp up worker insecurity, job insecurity, so that workers will, you know, be more docile and won't go on strike. And I think that looking at insecurity, recognizing just how widespread it is, can help us actually have empathy for each other and build powerful coalitions. I hope we can turn that insecurity into solidarity so that we can fight for the just and sustainable and collective forms of security that we really need.
And what would that solidarity look like? How do you think it could most effectively be expressed? And what about in this very polarized country, Republicans saying, yes, we're talking about a time of insecurity. They may not so much be focusing on inequality, to undermine and to go after, position themselves better for the next election.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the right wing is talking about insecurity. It's stoking it. It's speaking to people's fears and anxieties and trying to inflame them and misdirect them and say, okay, well, the problem is immigrants or trans kids or socialists or woke professors or whatever it is. So I think the we on the left and, you know, especially those of us who are organizing also need to speak to people's insecurities and recognize that it's really widespread. You know, even people who appear to be kind of getting ahead, you know, are always worried that the floor is going to fall out from under them. I mean, all it takes in this country is one medical emergency to devastate, you know, a seemingly middle class family. You know, even white collar professionals can be laid off at a moment's notice and don't have a robust safety net to catch them. We're all worried about natural disasters and pandemics. So I think, we can't cede that territory to the right wing. And it's our job to speak to the real fears people have and say, hey, these anxieties are things you actually have in common with each other. You know, let's fight for a world in which we're all taken care of. That's really what organizing is about. It's the alchemy of turning our vulnerabilities, turning our oppression, turning our insecurities into solidarity so that we can change the structures that are undermining our self-esteem and our well-being.
Very quickly, tell about what happened to your sister working in a coffee shop. You're concerned about surveillance. We only have 30 seconds.
Yeah, my sister was working at a hip Brooklyn cafe that seemed kind of retro and low tech. And it turned out that actually this charming cafe was a panopticon with at least 8 security cameras where the boss could tune in from any angle at any minute, you know, and tell the employees, hey, stop being so talkative, get to work. And those cameras weren't there to make the workers feel safe. They were there to make them feel like they could be fired at any minute. And that's a condition too many workers are experiencing. And it's emblematic of the ways that, you know, capitalism is an insecurity machine. It depends on all of us being insecure to amass power and profits. And we need something different.
Esther Taylor, thanks so much for being with us. Organizer with the Debt Collective, the new book, The Age of Insecurity, Coming Together as Things Fall Apart. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Did you know the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, a.k.a. SFPERG, has been leading social and environmental activism on campus for 40 years? SFPERG is student activism by students for students. Do you have a vision for a brighter future? Are you passionate about changing the world? Visit us at www.sfpirl.ca. That's www.sfpirl.ca to learn more about getting involved today.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia.